Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 223, The Caliper and the Lens, Gustav Fritsch, In the Southern Light. A very quick thank you to Professor Johan Fourie at Stellenbosch Department of Economics, who invited me to be part of a workshop about improving the visibility of economic history. It was an amazing experience. So this episode of our series is following on from 1863 into 1864 and 5, where the movement of people became a demographic phenomenon driven by economics and innovations. Let's swing our attention to Robben Island. It's a warm morning in November 1863, and a bearded German arrived armed with various photographic apparatus and guns. He was on an expedition. German tourists can be found on Robben Island these days, but they don't carry guns and their cameras are cannons. Gustav Fritsch had arrived with many other accoutrements, because he was on a scientific mission. He was an anthropologist and part of a curious genre, now forgotten, the racial type photographer. Men who believed the camera could capture the science of human difference, stamping evolution's hierarchy onto glass and paper. In their lens, the body became data. A century and a half later, modern influencers use images to shape a kind of social order. Their self-curated faces, Botox bright, and algorithm approved, offer a new kind of taxonomy, no less performative and perhaps no less pseudo-scientific. Gustav Fritsch was going to create quite a portfolio, so let's dive into this incredibly fascinating man. His methods formed part of the foundations of a new genre, photography, which advanced an earlier concept known as visionotrace, a late 18th century technique developed in 1796 for tracing human profiles onto glass using a stylus, producing images that could be engraved and reproduced in print, like photography. By the way, the earliest photograph taken in southern Africa was in 1845, and ominously was what was known as a racial type, taken from the side like a police ID pic of the 20th century. It was called a native woman of Sofala, which is a port in northern Mozambique. These photographs were part of a broader movement shaped by the ideas of Louis Agassiz, a prominent figure of the time, his theories linked biology to race. His views, now thoroughly discredited, were gaining traction across Europe and America, becoming something of the intellectual fashion of the day. In Germany, this early curiosity about racial types would later harden into something far more sinister, the pseudoscience that underpinned the Holocaust and the eugenics programs that followed. But in the 1860s, these were still the years of so-called scientific curiosity, when men with calipers and cameras believed they were simply documenting nature, not laying the groundwork for something far darker. Photographic portraiture replaced the older form, oil paintings, and these portraits were a form of honorific, a tradition. This tradition became subverted, and portrait photographs came eventually to be used in state classification and control. There's only a small skip between a physical stereotype and tests to check if you're white or black. Photography, unlike oil paintings, was reduced to the imperative of medical and anatomical illustration in the 1860s. Photography also delineated and delimited the terrain of the other, those people who looked different, and also simultaneously ordered what was known as the generalized look of a type of person. The typology. This is what a coy man looks like. This is what a German man looks like. The opposite of this was deviance. And deviants became the other, who did not look like German or coy, Arab, Jew, European, African. You can see where this is going. So as our friend Gustav Fritsch set up his apparatus and guns, there on the windy but warm Robben Island of November 1863, he became part of what would be the field of criminology and eugenics. In this period, the use of photography was part of a privileged administrative practice, part of medical anatomy, anthropology, psychiatry, part of the professionalized emerging social sciences, tying in public health, urban planning, sanitation. It was at this point that the two divergences in the science began to take shape. One was honorific, honoring the difference, noting the diversity, exciting the senses with these truly stunning pictures of South Africans in 1863, versus the other, the repressive, the oppressive, stamping people with their racial characteristics. Fritsch was a kind of virgin photographer. He was part of the honorific code. Sensing the poetry of beauty and diversity, his photographs retain a certain cultish grandeur, a fetish, a racial liberalism which his written travelogue exposes. The British and French had already launched an entire subgenre of social science called anthropology, while the Germans were still trying to figure out what that meant. Fritsch came to photography late, studying medicine first, and as a man of his time, he published an article on the insects of South Africa, then another on the climatic conditions of South Africa, and a third on the diseases of South Africa for various top-ranking journals in Europe before becoming a photographer. He then set off on an epic expedition through Southern Africa from the Cape in 1863, and during the next 3 years travelled into the western and eastern districts of the Cape Colony, the Orange Free State, and Bechuanaland, modern-day Botswana. 48 of his photographs can be found in the National Library of South Africa in Cape Town, while the Berlin Museum of Ethnology has around 90 others. His travels were 30 years before the amazingly portable box Brownie of the turn of the century, so Fritsch's kit included a huge tripod camera and boxes of chemicals and glass plates. He needed an ox wagon to carry the stuff. When he pitched up at Robben Island in November 1863, after sailing across Table Bay with all this paraphernalia, he pointed his infernal machine at the imprisoned Amakhosa chiefs. They'd been sent to prison following the last frontier war of 1858, and of course very different to later men who had been incarcerated at Robben Island, where photographs were basically banned. Gustav set up his tripod and asked permission from the chiefs to sit as if for a painted portrait. Back in the day, folks didn't sit completely still, like automatons. The koi moved about, the Amakhosa chiefs shifted their positions, looking around, shuffling and moving. Everything back in the day was about action and movement, urgency and energy. And unlike today, each picture took at least 20 seconds to complete. Imagine asking your contemporary subject to sit dead still for 20 seconds while you point your iPhone at their noggin. 20 seconds is longer than an entire TikTok video that explains the meaning of life. But there is no doubt that the most remarkable thing about Fritsch's photos were the diversity. He photographed many chiefs and their families, capturing African nobility at the time. He camped at Robben Island that November night, paying the chiefs a shilling each and handing out liberal doses of tobacco, paying his subjects, so to speak.
By way of an inducement, he wrote in his diary.
Recent publications of Robben Island use Fritsch's 1863 photo of Macoma as their cover. His reproductions are of such good quality. For goodness sake, this was 1863. The bloke's pictures grace Robben Island Museum in 2025. Pretty impressive. His image of Amatembu chief Stokwe Kaindlela is slightly blurred. Stokwe refused to sit still. Other images of the incarcerated on Robben Island are historic, folkloric, and well just stunning. These include Koko of the Nika, brother of Sandile, Siolo Ka Mdishani, one of the Tlaleka chiefs, Dilima, son of Pato of the Kunukwebe. This strange German was doing South African history a favour, recording the regal faces of Amakhosa royalty for posterity. After Robben Island, Gustav Fritsch and his apparatus rolled along in an ox wagon to Cathcart in the Eastern Cape, where he took more photos of Anta Kainika, the third paramount chief of the Rarabe, whereupon Fritsch continued to Stutterheim, where he set up his stool and massive tripod and took remarkable photographs of Sandile Kainika. Not satisfied, this 19th century paparazzi, this collector of images, set off northwards to Bechuanaland. He photographed Bakwena chief Sesheli A. Motswaseli, or Ra Mokonopi, as he was known, and his son Sibelo. Then Bamangwato chief Khama was next, the grand old man of Botswana, the ancestor of the famous Khama family of the 20th century. Motwani was an interesting addition. She was the wife of Khosi Khasetsiwe, a unifying ruler of the Bangwaketsi tribe in Botswana. Motwani was a significant figure in Bangwaketsi history. Known for her beauty and wise leadership, she can be seen today, staring straight back into the camera, unflinching, clearly unimpressed. Fritsch was an oddball drifter, trundling across the Southern African veld in his creaking ox wagon, a mobile alchemist's den stuffed with chemicals and glass plates, folding screens and brass-limbed tripods. He cut an unlikely figure, part scientist, part artist, part explorer, coaxing folks to sit still just long enough for a portrait. His lens caught a world in transition, a Korana woman staring into the camera, a 1,000-yard stare, melancholy depths untapped.
Chief Swart Faan and his father Gerrit, frozen in silver light. And even Umportla, the son of Mzilikazi Kakumalo of the Amandibeli, drawn into the curious spell of this peculiar European and his glinting, slow-eyed machine. Incredibly, he did not take any pictures of AmaZulu royalty. Perhaps he was nervous because AmaZulu under Mpandika Sesangakhona at this time were unconquered. He made up for that with a series of images that you could call Instagram-friendly, photos of everyday AmaZulu and their hairstyles. Fritsch called this complex cultural hairstyling practice civilized, which for a Victorian-era European was saying something. I will share some of these images on my site, desmondlatham.blog, in the next week or two. If you think hairstyles of today are strange and beautiful, you're in for a treat. It may not come as much of a surprise that many of the subjects he photographed had to be convinced that stealing an image was not weakening their place in the cosmos. People of all kinds, black and white, were nervous of this device, this technology he assembled after dragging it out of his wagon, the paraphernalia of 19th century innovation from across the ocean. Most subjects agreed to sit for a portrait because they were paid a few shillings for the experience, and many of these showed a great fear of the bulky apparatus. Most people didn't smile in those old images of the 19th century. Why were they such a serious bunch? Photographs were replacing portraits, and portraits were deadly serious. Smiling for 20 seconds flat could make you look a little bit of an idiot. In the early days of photography, portraiture didn't stray far from its painted predecessor. Photographs of the 19th century mimicked the conventions of oil portraiture with almost theatrical devotion. Sitters were posed with a studied gravity, often beside heavy drapery or ornamental columns or a potted fern thrown in for a whiff of Victorian refinement. Hands were carefully arranged, folded, resting on a book, or perched awkwardly on a prop table, all meant to suggest dignity, literacy, and a robust moral character. The photographic studio was a curious blend of science lab and parlor theater. The long exposure times demanded heroic stillness, so sitters were often clamped into hidden braces to prevent an accidental wobble. Blink at the wrong moment and you'd emerge ghost-like, eyes half shut for eternity. Children, of course, were the greatest challenge. Many were propped up with cushions and held firmly by a parent hidden behind a curtain. One can imagine the resulting portraits, proud matriarchs and patriarchs staring solemnly into the lens while somewhere off frame someone was sweating buckets trying to keep a toddler from bolting mid-exposure. It was all serious business and faintly absurd. A hint of jaunty vaudeville. The result, however, was magical. The stiff formality of painted portraiture made suddenly real, caught in light and metal, a glimpse into another time, another time's presence and its pose and poise. Gustav Fritsch brought this whole theatrical tradition, backdrops, dignity and all, bumping and swaying over the rough tracks of Southern Africa in his ox wagon. Far from the plush velvet chairs of Berlin salons, he staged his portraits on termite hills and thorn-felt clearings where chiefs and herders and curious children sat bolt upright beneath the harsh African sun, replicating the same composure expected in European parlours. His camera demanded silence and stillness. His subjects, bemused, met the lens with a mixture of curiosity and caution. Somewhere just beyond the frame, a servant held up a backdrop. A cow chewed reflectively, and Fritsch counted the seconds with the precision of a man who knew both the chemistry of light and drama of the pose. By 1864, people were aware of what was going on. This German was travelling around South Africa snapping portraits. And in that year, a Free State farmer living on Bain's farm invited Fritsch to pop in and photograph San men and women who lived there. A San woman called Sanna is shown with a blanket around her shoulders, a necklace and striking strings of white beads in her hair. Carlo, her son, a youngster who the Free State farmer boasted had fought off a hyena with his bare hands, with his metal chain across his chest. 1860s bling, a mixture of San ancestry and modernity, very proud. Busek, the old Sandman, photographed from the side like police file, a mass of wrinkles captured so fantastically by this ancient camera, the veins on his forehead clearly visible, his headgear exotic, a swathe of white feathers like a sand wig, a traditional toupee. In October the following year, Gustav trundled down the mountains to Durban, where he again set up his immense tripod.
These portraits are the only known surviving photographic record of the first wave of Indian immigrants, the indentured labourers brought into Natal. The three men he photographed are called merely Venkatasani, Kuta, and a man. Symbolic then for an entire people, something like the unknown soldier. His photos of young African women are striking head and shoulder shots. Kwenyani of the Baralong is dressed traditionally, including a long bead necklace, staring with a burning intensity into the Victorian lens. This oddball of the era, Fritsch, returned to Germany with his precious glass plates, pressing copies for posterity. Apart from their fine quality, they remain an incredibly diverse collection of early South African art. They have specific power. Both royalty and common are represented in honour, with leopard tooth necklaces, felt hats, military outfits, chains, waistcoats, feathers, cravats, earrings, horns, blankets, crosses, hairpins, and handkerchiefs. Although he appears to have tried to drum up a scientific type of person for each ethnicity, he was constantly frustrated by the vast differences within each group. Fritsch writes about his quest to record types of race.
In one area, he writes in his memoirs, the mixed race, it is mostly the Hottentot type, the mid-pointy face, flat nose, and that yellow-brown colour you see. But ach, it is difficult, said difficult, to identify a pure race and to get the proper photographs of such peoples.
Excuse the poor German accent. That determination to discover the noble savage, the pure line of skin and bone, that elusive lie that is told about some Aryan myth or some bloodline that is perfectly unique. He finds to his complete shock that even amongst AmaZulu, the
external appearance, it is so diverse, yeah, that it is difficult to fix an exact type. There is great diversity in the skin color, and while it is usually deep, dark brown, some have lighter, more reddish-brown tones.
This obsession with precise skin tone was going to get South Africans in a lot of trouble. Later, Gustav Fritsch's photographs would be used by those with a preoccupation for craniometry, a disturbing scientific endeavour that sought to place black people on a lower rung than whites on the scale of evolution by measuring the size of skulls. Fritsch's photographs would be used in a far less noble series of scientific publications as models against which supposed deficiencies of African physique were compared with the European. Around the same period, what was called the Abantu, or the Nguni word for people, began to be used as a linguistic category and turned into a racial category. So it is no surprise that at about this time in history, another word also emerged, Caucasian, dreamed up by anthropologist Johannes Blumenbach. His Caucasian racial type was based on the configuration of a single skull he found in the Caucasus. He also believed races of the world should be chopped up into five types: Oriental, American Indian, Caucasian, Malay, and Ethiopian. He assumed that all differences between the varieties were induced by the climate and the way they lived. His Dutch contemporary, Pieter Kamper, introduced the concept of the facial angle as a racial marker. This was defined by drawing a line from the tip of the chin to the top of the forehead and then measuring the angle it formed with a horizontal line drawn from the base of the nose. Kamper believed this angle could be used to compare different human groups and even animals, with a large angle suggesting a more noble profile, according to the pseudo-scientific thinking of the time. Fritsch then developed a bizarre habit of collecting human skulls. They were his friends on his travels, sitting with him in his ox wagon. He gave them names, called them pretty or graceful. So there it is, our conflicted history, glimpsed through the dark glass of a 19th century social scientist slash photographer. He was fumbling toward a kind of method and order, a truth he believed lay buried in the bones and faces of men. And all the while, the very peoples he tried to pin down were already slipping beyond his grasp, merging and shifting and mutating and gyrating, immigrating, intermingling, miscegenating. The categories blurred even as he captured them. The experiment was already undone by the life he tried to catalogue. He wasn't alone. Dozens of thinkers of the 1860s, naturalists, anatomists, ethnographers, were driven by a fierce conviction that Darwinian evolution explained not just species but societies. They scoured skulls and measured limbs, believing that intelligence could be ranked by bone structure, that physiology could chart the rungs of the human ladder. What these people could not see What lay entirely beyond the reach of their instruments and racial taxonomies was that the very people they measured, the San, the Karan, and the Khoikhoi, were bearers of a genetic heritage that stretched back further than Europe's own. Genomic studies, only possible in our own century, would show that Southern Africa holds some of the oldest and most diverse human lineages on Earth. Gustav, with all his European credentials, stood before individuals shaped by a deeper timescale, although he saw only types to be catalogued. He was preserving the traces of a vanishing people, and he was looking at ancestral depth he could neither measure nor imagine. Only now, in the early 21st century, have the codes within these bodies begun to break through science, revealing a depth the old race thinkers could never have imagined. And yet, we still grapple with the residue of these myths. The photographs remain stark and powerful, but so too do the fixations. Those who gaze on these images see only race, only surface, and imagine that as essence, as the relic, or as a treasure. In 1863, just before Fritsch headed off in his ox wagon, Thomas Huxley published Evidence as to Man's Place in Nature, seeking to reinforce evolutionary theory through comparative anatomy, laying out diagrams of apes and humans to show our kinship, but also drawing subtle lines between types of human. These ideas travel fast. In settler colonies like the Cape, they gave intellectual sheen to dispossession and provided a so-called scientific rationale for hierarchy. Racial science was not fringe. It was paraded in royal society meetings and embedded in colonial administrations. Ethnographic exhibitions, sometimes called human zoos, were beginning to emerge in Europe, turning living people into evidence of evolutionary difference. And here on the southern edge of Africa, these ideas took root. Missionaries recorded physical features in their journals. Collectors sent hair samples and jawbones to Berlin. The frontier became not just a place of political conflict, but of classificatory obsession. So while Gustav Fritsch wandered the felt with his camera and his paraphernalia, convinced he was capturing some scientific truth, the people he encountered were being absorbed into a global archive, not as individuals, but as specimens, artifacts, and case studies. That too offers a quiet reflection for our present, a reminder that the urge to measure and sort by race has a long and unsettling lineage. Today, the strain of African nationalism risks becoming a pseudoscience caliper of its own when obsession with origins begins to blur the complexity of lived experience. It is apartheid's arithmetic dressed in struggle regalia, the same tape measure, now wielded with quasi-revolutionary flair. Fluent in the language of grievance in the theatre of justice, it reduces complexity to pigment and pigment to policy, the outcome, a bureaucracy of skin tones. Next episode, the period of floods that followed a period of droughts and how the climate of South Africa was changing through the 1860s. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about this episode and others. You can email me from there. Until we meet again, mach's gut. Thank you.